I mention that because the program that we're about to hear and the author that we're about to hear from are part of a track of sessions that my colleagues and I, who are all fellows at the Warren Center for the Humanities this year, have put together around a theme that we share an interest in, and that is taking our pulse, promises and pitfalls of modern medicine. Several of the talks on our track, which is all, of course, taking place within this larger, wonderful festival, are going to be held in this room. And so I have these brochures, if you're interested, and other speakers that are on related topics to, you know, the situation we're in at the moment with regard to modern medicine in just about every sense of the word situation, the political situation, the personal situation, and everything in between. Because we have had such a great partnership with Humanities Tennessee to put together this program, I wanted to make sure to thank the Warren Center for the Humanities at Vanderbilt for the funding that enabled us to bring in such wonderful authors. And we also received support from the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. So we thank them as well. Our author in today's session is Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Before Katie wrote this book that she'll be discussing today, her words had already reached many people. She'd had a long career as a successful journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and her work had also been published in such diverse outlets as The New Yorker, The Best American Science Writing, and, I love this one, The Best Buddhist Writing. Many of us, I suspect, first heard her voice through a 2010 essay, What Broke My Father's Heart, which was published in the New York Times Magazine. There she described, and I remember the day I read it, in honest and gripping terms, the story of her aging parents, and in particular, the story of how, when, and why the doctors put a pacemaker in her father against some of their own better wishes, or against some of the family's wishes, I guess, was how we'll say that. The piece, it turns out, was the fourth most emailed magazine story in the New York from the New York Times that year. That's how much attention it got. That's how many people needed to hear that story. Knocking on Heaven's Door picks up on that story, telling us more of it, and Katie's story too, but also showing readers a bigger picture indeed. It's part memoir and part investigative journalism, and it really asks us a very basic question. Has modern medicine, in its frequent quest to avoid death at all costs, and I mean that literally, has it also created a great deal of suffering along the way? As one reviewer wrote it, Butler's ordeal, quote, has become a rallying cry for the 24 million U.S. caregivers tending to elderly parents, adult children who are often overwhelmed and overlooked by a profit-driven healthcare system that puts expensive, high-tech treatments before in-home healthcare. Knocking on Heaven's Door has gotten a lot of attention, and a lot of people want to hear this story. It's currently a bestseller in San Francisco, Denver, and on other regional lists, and it's in the New York Times top 25 bestseller list. As Katie noted to me in some recent correspondence, this is not bad for a book that, one, has death in the title, two, is by a first-time book author, and three, is by a first-time book author writing her first book at age 64. Yes. I am pleased to introduce to you today our author, Katie Butler, and she'll be speaking about Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. I just want to check the sound. Is it working? You can hear? Great. Yeah, so the book is about some complicated, difficult conversations that I think as a culture we have not been having, and that we really need to have. And they're conversations that are frightening and daunting to us, but they also have an opportunity for being deeply spiritually satisfying and lessening the amount of suffering that people are going through in the last phase of their lives now. 3/4 of us say we want to die at home, but actually only 1/4 of us do. And most die in hospitals and in nursing homes. And 1/5 of the people who don't die at home die in intensive care units. And this is about as harrowing a kind of death than I can imagine anyone inventing, because people are literally either strapped down or drugged so that they won't tear the tubes out that are binding them to this earth. I think it's very important for me to make clear that I'm not arguing for neglecting the people we love in the last phase of their lives. We have a medical system that is biased towards curing and against caring. For example, my poor dad had a major stroke at 79. A year later was given a pacemaker, which he kind of pressured into. He needed a hernia surgery, and the cardiologist would not give him a clearance unless he got a pacemaker because he had a slow heartbeat, even though the slow heartbeat was not creating a problem. It was kind of a just-in-case decision. But unfortunately, it had long-term implications long after what looked like a no-brainer was done. So as he descended into dementia and got to the point where I had to coach him to put his slippers on, I mean, to take his slippers off before he put his shoes on, and my mother was suffering deeply with exhaustion as well as loss and grieving as she cared for this extremely damaged man that she loved so, so deeply. I saw the implications of how a little medical decision can have long-term implications in terms of maximizing everyone's suffering. And I really couldn't rest until I wrote the book and really explored how our medical system had got to this point. So, for example, Medicare paid $7,500 for my father's pacemaker, but it would only have paid the family doctor, who was opposed to it, $54 to have a very serious discussion with the family about whether or not this was a good idea. And my father really benefited from speech therapy in the aftermath of his stroke, but Medicare would only pay $1,500 a year for speech therapy, and he had to prove that he was improving. It wasn't enough to just keep him maintaining at the level he was at. So there's this penny-wise, pound-foolish bias in our medical system, which funnels us often toward deaths that leave the survivors traumatized. ICU deaths leave people with very high rates of, the survivors, with very high rates of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, and in my experience, just from talking to people, a lot of sibling conflict. You know, a lot of siblings who aren't talking to each other after the experience. So I'm kind of on a bit of a mission now to try to improve the way we die. And I think there's always going to be a lot of suffering and difficulty in the process of dying. I love the idea of the good death, but I don't think we should be tyrannized by it and think that if we don't provide the perfect death to the people we loved, we failed somehow. But I really would like to see us eliminate some of the unnecessary suffering that is occurring now as a result of, in essence, in the 1960s, we invented a panoply of life-saving devices. Pacemakers, defibrillators, respirators, dialysis. It was like a burst of creative invention after World War II. And these devices were mostly intended to get someone over a brief, temporary health crisis. And they were called bridge technologies. But they've really become bridges to nowhere because they're now being used on people who are at the end of their lives. And so people are sacrificing the possibility of having meaningful conversations with people they love prior to their deaths because they're fighting till the very last minute. And then the family's unprepared. The person who's dying is unprepared. This is a total reverse of our religious traditions. Up until about 1900, the virtuous person of faith accepted the coming of death as God's will and prayed for patience and prayed for faith. And all of the family members would gather around the bed and help out, and the death would take place at home. And family members were actually, there were actually books called The Art of Dying. They started being written in the 1450s, and they continued as a religious tradition up until the 1800s. Family members were actually given kind of scripts of the questions to ask, how to reassure the person on the deathbed. And I think we stopped worshiping at the altar of our religions in the 60s, and in some ways we transferred that worship to science, technology, and medicine. And we lost a lot of those traditions, and I think we need to bring them back in ways that are meaningful for us now. So I want you to also know that this is not purely, it's not a polemic. This book is not a polemic. There's a lot of investigative reporting in it about the rise of the medical device industry and the history of medicine. But I like to think of it fundamentally as a love story. Because I fell in love with my parents all over again in the last 7 years of their lives when I became their long-distance caregiver and helper out. So I want to show you some pictures of them. This is my father and mother shortly after they met. They're on the campus of a college in South Africa. They were both South Africans. And I think you can see just their enormous fun-loving quality and their zest and guts. My mother has just run a foot race. She's run it barefoot, which seems to be a South African habit. I'm not sure why. And it started to rain, and so she's been folded into my father's army overcoat. And he lost his arm in the Second World War. You can't really see it in this picture, but he did, and he very nearly died and would have died if it had not been for penicillin, which was just coming online. So they were gutsy lovers of life, and they were not opposed to medicine. It saved their lives, both of their lives. My mother had breast cancer later in her life and survived. And yet they really believe that there comes a point where less is more and where life stops being a blessing and becomes a burden or a curse. And they did not want that to happen to them. So this is this is me and my parents about 2 years after my father's stroke, about a year after the pacemaker went in. And I think you can see my mother's exhaustion, and you can see my father's perpetual confusion. From that time on, he very, very rarely smiled. And what I remember him saying over and over again is some equivalent of, "What's happening now? What are you saying?" It's just very tragic to me, even like right at this very minute, to think that his worst chapter of life was prolonged by at least a couple of years by having a device in his heart that really prevented him from having what would have been the most merciful death, which was to simply have his heart stop and have him die in his sleep. Okay. And I think you can see me. You can see my total optimism and, you know, I think like everything, you know, I'm gonna save the day and come in as the cavalry. And I think I had no idea what was coming down the pike for all of us at this point. So I'm going to talk just a little about my mother's death and then read from the book. And then hopefully we'll have a discussion, because I really feel this book is an excuse for a public conversation that really needs to take place. So this is my mom, probably around the age of 60 or so. And as you can see, she remained a very beautiful woman all through her life, into her old age. And after my father finally did die of pneumonia on a hospice unit, she needed open heart surgery to fix two leaky heart valves. And she thought about it very seriously. Several people, including me, were kind of encouraging her to do it. And she refused because it had dangers of dementia and stroke. And she was not willing to run those risks, and she was 84. And she had a right to choose the nature of her death, as far as I'm concerned. She died 5 months later, and before she died, she really had the opportunity to make peace with one of my brothers, to apologize to me for something very, very minor, which is that I'd made her a beautiful little book for her 80th birthday, and she called me and said, "Oh, Katie, I found that little book. It's so beautiful and so loving, and I just didn't appreciate it at the time." So because she had the gift of knowing that her death was coming, she was able to just intuitively do these final tasks of life, which I think of as, "I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, thank you, and goodbye." Because Nobody deprived her. Nobody gave her false hope. Nobody told her everything was going to be fine, that she was going to get through this and surmount this. She had an opportunity to die a meaningful, not an easy death, but a meaningful and loving death. And so I hope, I really want to get across that this book is not all like, you know, a grim attack on the American medical system or something. There's a lot of love in it and a lot of redemption. So now I'm going to read then. Well, so I'm going to read from the prologue. On an autumn day in 2007, while I was visiting from California, my mother made a request I both dreaded and longed to fulfill. She just poured me a cup of tea from her Japanese teapot, shaped like a little pumpkin. Beyond the kitchen window, two cardinals splashed in her birdbath in the weak Connecticut sunlight. Her white hair was gathered at the nape of her neck, and her voice was low. She put a hand on my arm. "Please help me get your father's pacemaker turned off," she said. I met her eyes, and my heart knocked. Directly above us, in what was once my parents' shared bedroom, my 85-year-old father, Jeffrey, a retired Wesleyan University professor, stroke-shattered, going blind, and suffering from dementia, lay sleeping. Sewn into a hump of skin and muscle below his right collarbone was the pacemaker that had helped his heart outlive his brain. As small and shiny as a pocket watch, it had kept his heart beating rhythmically for 5 years. It blocked one path to a natural death. I don't like describing what the thousand shocks of late old age were doing to my father, and indirectly to my mother, without telling you first that my parents loved each other and I loved them. That my mother could stain a deck, sew a silk blouse from a photo in Vogue, and make coq au vin with her own chicken stock. That she thought of my father as her best friend. And that my father never gave up easily on anything. Excuse me. Born in South Africa's Great Karoo Desert, he was a 21-year-old soldier in the South African Army when he lost his left arm to a German shell in the Italian hills outside Siena. He went on to marry my mother, earn a PhD from Oxford, coach rugby, build floor-to-ceiling bookcases for our living room, and with my two brothers as crew, sail his beloved Rhodes 19 on Long Island Sound. Sorry. When I was a teenager and often at odds with him, he would sometimes wake me chortling lines from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam in a high falsetto, "Awake, my little one, before life's liquor in its cup be dry." Thank you. At night, he would stand in our bedroom doorways and say goodnight to my two brothers and me, quoting Horatio's farewell to the dying Hamlet, "May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest." 4 decades later, in the house where he once chortled and strutted and sometimes thundered, I had to coach him to take off his slippers before he tried to put on his shoes. My mother put down her teacup. She was 83, as lucid and bright as a sword point, and more elegant in her black jeans and thin cashmere sweater than I could ever hope to be. She put a hand hard on my arm. "He is killing me," she said. "He is ruining my life." She was taking care of my father for about 100 hours a week. I looked at her and thought of Anton Chekhov, the writer and physician who died of tuberculosis in 1904, when he was only 44. Whenever there is someone in a family who has long been ill and hopelessly ill, he wrote, there come painful moments when all, timidly, secretly, at the bottom of their hearts, long for his death. A century afterward, my mother and I had come to long for the machine in my father's heart to fail. This was a moral choice for which neither the Anglicanism of my English childhood nor my adopted Buddhism had prepared me. I shook when I imagined watching someone disable his pacemaker, and shook even more when I imagined trying to explain it to him. At the same time, I feared that if I did nothing, his doctors would continue to prolong what was left of my father's life until my mother went down with him. I loved my father, even as he was, miserable, damaged, and nearly incommunicado. I loved my mother, and I wanted her to have at least the chance of a happy widowhood. I felt like my father's executioner, and that I had no choice. I met my mother's eyes and said yes. So that's what I'm going to read. That's what I've read. And I'm very interested in a conversation about this. Questions you have about the book itself, about dilemmas you face or have faced. And as I said, I don't think any of these are easy questions, and that different families and different people draw the line in a different place. And so I don't want anything that I've said or read from the book to give you the sense that any of this was easy for us. I think these were probably the hardest moral choices I ever faced in my life, and that I had to really think, what is the loving thing to do here? Not as the thing that was necessarily going to make me feel comfortable, but what is my moral responsibility as a daughter who loves these two people so deeply? What is my moral responsibility in this situation where the technology will keep going no matter what, and that if we human beings don't figure out how to practice discernment and know when these things are helpful and when they've reached their limit, we're really in trouble, I think, as a culture. So thank you very much. So if you have questions, if you could line up at the mic. Yeah.
Hi there. Yeah. I'm Pat Hausman's daughter.
Oh.
Rachel. The article in the New York Times changed a lot of things that could have happened toward the end of my mother's life. And there's a lot of decisions to make, and none of them are easy for those of us who are watching. Somebody who's just too young to die. I have, you know, the hindsight, and I know how much worse it could have been. And the things that you wrote down were so instructive. I made everybody read that article. I mean, I just made everybody read it. And it allowed us to have conversations, adult, painful, grown-up conversations. In hindsight, I think one thing I would have done differently was use outside help more. My parents were, you know, they worked hard, they saved hard, they did all the right stuff, so they, fortunate, because I know that's not common, had the ability to hire out. I would have done that more, because what I didn't do was allow myself enough time just to be my mom's daughter.
Yeah.
I needed to be her daughter, because anytime she ever introduced me to anybody, it was, and this is my baby. And what I've learned is not only did I lose that person, but I lost who I was in relation to that person, to not be ever introduced again as this is my baby.
Right.
And I would have given myself more opportunity to do that. So in hindsight, because you wrote about it and thought about it, what would you have done differently?
Along the same lines, I would have asked for more help across the board, including putting more pressure on my brothers who were a little bit absent. I would have actually said to them, look, this is your moral responsibility. There's a whole change here now. This is not about being given to by our parents anymore. It's about them needing us. So that's definitely I would have done. I wish I had known and understood more about hospice and palliative care earlier in the game. A lot of people are afraid of hospice because they feel like it means a death sentence, but it actually doesn't do anything to change the diagnosis of the person. And in fact, people in hospice and palliative care programs often outlive people who are getting maximum treatment. So palliative care is a wonderful new specialty, which is really like old-fashioned doctoring. You really get the help of an entire team. There's a lot more time spent on talking to you about symptoms, what we can do to make your daily life feel better. And I was just on a panel actually about a week ago with a guy at Stanford University, and he had been given something called an internal defibrillator, which shocks your heart back. And he'd finally asked to have this defibrillator turned off because he has congestive heart failure and he is in the last chapter of his life. And the irony is that he got transferred to the palliative care program. They paid a lot more. They said, "What's wrong? What's wrong? Why is your life not worth living?" And he said, "Well, I want to be able to go down in my workshop and make little toys that I give to the neighborhood kids. And my breathing is so difficult now, I can't do that." So they gave him oxygen, they adjusted his meds, and he's now has a much higher quality of life. And he's more happy to be surviving now. So there's some great ironies and paradoxes here that sometimes when you stop trying so hard to save life or extend life, you actually can drastically improve its quality. So I would say, knowing there was such a thing as palliative care, bringing them in earlier, getting into a hospice system if you can, that's a six-month benefit, so it's not just for the last 3 days of life. Okay, yeah.
You mentioned false hope. Yeah. I assume that that's what I guess the medical industry might give some people with devices. So I'm wondering, do you think that the better death you mentioned involves a certain amount of losing hope? And if so, how do you go about discussing that with a person who may not have given up hope yet?
It's really tough and hard to answer as a, you know, like a bumper sticker, you know? I think we need to adjust our expectations of the last chapter of life. You can have all kinds of healing without being able to extend longevity any further. So I think there's a very difficult shift in goals and introspection about one's deepest values that needs to take place. I had a conversation with my mother where, you know, she refused all this open heart surgery and then she had a heart attack. And after the heart attack, the cardiologist came back again and wanted to do all the same surgeries she had rejected plus another, you know, a heart bypass too. And I called her up and said, "I think we're grasping at straws." And she was quiet for a minute and she said, "It's hard to give up hope." And then the phone call ended, and about 4 hours later, she called me back, and she said, "I want you to give my sewing machine to a woman who really sews. It's a Bernina. It's all metal. It has no plastic parts, okay?" And she, yes, that was a hard conversation where I said, "I think we're grasping at straws," which was true. And I think we sell ourselves and the people we love short. People have faced their deaths for millennia. And, I mean, that was a conversation that fit for our family. You know, to be that blunt, that fit for our family. It wouldn't necessarily be the same for your family. It could be a very different kind of conversation. But I think at least having an understanding that we're approaching the end of our lives, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be a week from now, it may be several months, but to at least have that phrase in the room, you know, you are approaching the end of your life. Because we deprive people of such possible spiritual blessings if they die completely unprepared, they don't get to give their blessings to their kids, they don't get to say their last words or clean up what needs to be cleaned up. So I don't know, I hope that's of some help. Someone said to me recently, in a totally different context, fear is 10 miles wide and 10 miles high, but it's actually only paper thin. And that once you walk through that, you can have amazing conversations. And actually, a lot of people I know have sent this book to family members and allowed it to be the opener for a conversation that really needed to happen. You know, sometimes it's the person, sometimes it's the kids who can't let go, you know? Yeah.
I have two situations.
Yeah.
One is very close to what you had with your father. My mother was given a pacemaker, although she'd been very healthy and active all of her life, but she had atrial fibrillation, and it was supposed to help that. In the end, she had a stroke anyway, yeah, and lived 2 years in a nursing home and could not get out of bed. And it was very, very hard for all of us. There were 8 of us. And very hard for all of us to watch her to be in that condition. And some of us actually questioned whether the pacemaker actually delayed the death that would have been far more natural. Anyway, the second situation is my mother-in-law had cancer, had been treated over a year for lung cancer. The doctor had told her at the beginning if she didn't have treatment, she would die within 2 weeks. She lived long enough to see her one of her granddaughters be married, one of her 3 granddaughters, the only one she could see be married. She lived to her 80th birthday. We celebrated that the same weekend. And then 2 weeks later, she went in with kidney failure and into the hospital. And the doctor said, oncologists, I have a hard time with if they're not ready to give up when it's time. And it was time for her really to give up. But he walked in and said, oh, if this doesn't, we're going to try and flush the kidneys. If that doesn't work, we'll do dialysis. And my husband and I looked at each other and said, what? She's been through enough. And it had gone to her liver. It was out throughout her body. And I actually had to go out to the desk and say, why? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to do? And they ended up, a few days later, the flushing did work, and they ended up giving her more chemo, mm-hmm, to try and help her, and she died the next day. Yeah. It taught me a great lesson in thinking about my own time coming. I'm 65. My own time is coming. And we are now having conversations with our 3 daughters and saying, and I'm just learning about palliative care, things like that. You know, that's so much more humane. Do you think as a society, mm-hmm, that we're actually away from it? One of the things with my mother-in-law, the doctor said one thing, that's what it was going to be. The doctor told them what to do. Do you think as a generation of older people, mm-hmm, who are aging, are we moving away from that? Are we becoming more aware that we have the options? And do you think as a society that these are, you know, again, and we are growing in that way?
Yeah. I feel sort of both ways about it. I do think the older generation is more deferent to authority, and baby boomers are famous for saying question authority. But on the other hand, I've watched friends who are baby boom generation have as much terror as, excuse me. have as much terror of death and as much inability to face it. We had a friend who had multiple melanomas, all riddled through his body by the time they were discovered. And what was so unfortunate is he was given all this bad news, and then within 2 hours he was told, this is the plan, we're going to do whole brain radiation, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And there was not even a pause. There was not even a conversation with a social worker to say, what's it like for you to digest this news? And what do you want? So I feel both ways about it. I think there'll be more questioning, but I think the terror of death is very, very fundamental, and this is not easy for any generation, you know. And I also want to say there are lots of very well-intentioned doctors out there who are either in these palliative care or hospice or family medicine who are frankly quietly horrified by what's going on. I get emails, again, almost every day from a doctor saying, I get paid more for putting someone in intensive care than I do for having a conversation with them about a less invasive approach. What can I do about this? And I'm thinking, like, I'm just a writer. You know, I have no idea. So I think it's very important not to sell doctors short because they're well-intentioned. Most of them have absolutely no training in difficult end-of-life or advanced illness conversations. And so it's not surprising they would sort of kind of revert to a reflexive mode of treat, 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 rather than talk. Okay, yeah.
I have two questions. The easy one will come first. What, besides your book, what's the book that you recommend everybody in this room read?
I have two. One is My Mother, Your Mother by Dr. Dennis McCulloch. It's a wonderful book written by a super geriatrician, and it's about medical caregiving in the last phase of life of your parents, and it's just a beautiful book. There's another one. It's a thin pamphlet. It's called Hard Choices for Loving People, and it's by a hospice chaplain named Hank Dunn, and it really goes through the moral implications and the practicalities of saying yes or no to all of these various treatments like feeding tubes or even antibiotics when you're dealing with someone with late-stage dementia who is miserable. So those are the two that I recommend.
And I know there's a statistic out there, data about mm-hmm. healthcare costs in the last 6 months or a year of life.
Yeah.
What would you say have to say about the Affordable Care Act?
Sorry, I'm not usually like this. A quarter of Medicare spending is for the last year of life. A fifth of people die in intensive care. A third are in intensive care in the last year of life. And a third get some form of what is often a Hail Mary surgery in the last year of life. So this is incredibly expensive. Unfortunately or unfortunately, I don't know, the Affordable Care Act really doesn't address this very much. It really is handling insuring everybody, but it is really not, there's not a lot built in there to change how money is spent. You know, because I'd like to see a lot of that end-of-life money spent in different ways. You know, more hospice, longer stays in hospice, more home care, all of these things. It's not like it would eliminate all these costs, but they would be spent very differently. So it's really kind of a wash, and they did try to put a $200 payment for doctors to have very serious end-of-life conversations, and that was mischaracterized as death panels and had to be stripped from the bill because it would have killed it, you know. So they're trying to reintroduce it now as a standalone thing, but I don't know what will happen. Yeah.
I'm much younger than my two brothers. They're 11 and 8 years older. One was a doctor, one was a lawyer. When my father had cancer, somehow I was told he had about a 50% chance to make it. And apparently they were told there was no chance. And it left me in a funny position. Somebody, I'm sure, decided to cut things off. But it seems it's important to let everybody know what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's very important. And sometimes, you know, I'm a journalist. I could say, so I have like 30 years experience with this. You have to ask a lot of hard and detailed questions. I mean, one of the obvious ones is, if I get this test, is it going to change how I'm treated? You know, because there's no point in giving a mammogram to someone in their last 6 months of life when you're not going to treat with them with chemo anyway. I had a friend whose sister had ovarian cancer, and so the sister, who was also a journalist, went in to the discussion, and she had had a round of chemo, and the cancer had returned. And the doctor said, a lot of people get a good response from this yet another round of chemo. And my friend asked, what do you consider, what is a lot of people? It turned out to be 17%. And what is a good response? An extra 3 or 4 weeks of life. So you've got to kind of unpack, which, again, as someone stood up to say, I mean, at a very time, Rachel, you know, at a very time when you actually want to collapse into the hands of a loving community, you're unfortunately put in a position where you actually need to be quite assertive and discerning and somewhat skeptical about the information you get. It's a horrendous situation. And again, I think if we embrace hospice, palliative care, at least they're even inventing a new profession called decision coaches. And these are not doctors, but they're employed by hospitals. So you actually get some sort of social work help where you can come to terms with what can be some very difficult information that you don't want to hear, you know. Yeah.
Hi. My mom is a hospice nurse, and she has been able to guide her father through his death by turning down overly extensive care. And now her mother is in heart failure and is helping her through that same process. And I am a writer and a wellness, health and wellness writer, a personal trainer, and have written a memoir / health and wellness teaching sort of book. And I'm curious to know how much of your book is personal memoir experience and how much of it is journalistic, and then what some of the key messages from the journalism came out through the end. Yeah.
Thank you. It was a very challenging book to write. And so I'm going to talk as a writer now for a minute or two. There were two things that made it challenging. I would say it's maybe half and half, or probably 60% personal story and 40% investigative reporting. So the reporting chapters are very important, but they're not the dominant note, I don't think, of the book. So as a writer, there were a lot of very interesting writing challenges here, because number one was, if you look, you know, you like to kind of have some kind of turning point, some kind of upward message, some kind of hope in the course of a book. You can't get people to read a book that is just unrelieved despair, right? So it's, if you just trace my father's trajectory, it's kind of like he had a great life, he had a very full life, and then he had a stroke, then he got a pacemaker, then he got worse, then he got worse, then he got worse, then he finally died, okay? Now that alone is not a trajectory that anyone is going to read a book, a full book, if that's it, right? And so I had to also really tease out a different narrative thread, which was my mother and I had a lot of redemption and a lot of love and a lot of healing with my parents as a result of being with them and agreeing to go with them through this. And my mother and I got closer. My mother and I got more and more sophisticated and skeptical about medicine as usual. And then finally, my mother completely rebelled. And so at that point, it becomes a kind of a rebellion story or a fight against the monster story, like St. George and the Dragon, you know, so that there was, in fact, a great deal of triumph and a great deal of healing and empowerment in the family story, even though, obviously, both my parents die in the course of the book. So it was very important to construct hope, surprise, redemption. All of these things happened for us, including, which I only realized as I wrote the book, that at the points where our family was in the deepest despair and we had totally run out of ideas and we were beyond our own resources, it's like an angel would show up from the outside. You know, in the first case, it was a caregiver who was 5 years sober. She had a severe mental illness that prevented her from working more than a few hours a week. I mean, managed mental illness. And my mother was kind of terrified of hiring her. She was a friend of one of my brothers. And, you know, she was 5 years clean and sober. And she was an absolute godsend. And she was a rock for us. And she had a wisdom and a kindness that we desperately needed. So that was also something that I actually, part of the plot of the book that I only realized in the course of actually writing it. I sort of looked back at what I'd read and thought, oh my God, these people, they just showed up and they saved us. So that's that plot part. And the other question I think I've really talked about the journalistic, there's a chapter I found absolutely fascinating, which was I wrote about the invention of the pacemaker. The first pacemaker that actually went inside someone's body was actually put together in a kiwi shoe can. You know, they put it in, then they filled, you know, put all the components in, then they filled it up with medical epoxy, and then they stuck it in the guy's abdomen and ran the wires to his heart. And this was a young guy, it was a guy in his 40s in Sweden, and this thing really did literally save his life, and he kept going till he was in his 80s. So I loved researching that chapter and writing about this rise and then how it really transformed and deformed our experience of death, all of these inventions that were so well-intentioned and then, in a sense, so misused later on. So there's a lot about that. And then there's a very heavy chapter about the medical device industry and how incredibly profitable it is. It's like a 20% profit margin year in and year out. And one of the big reasons for this whole shutdown of the government is that that industry was being subjected to a 2.5% tax. And that was one of the big reasons that that small group of Republicans shut the government down, was to try to roll that tax back. These businesses have enormous lobbies. They're not in the business of setting healthcare policy for the country. They are in the business of maximizing and extending markets, which is what they're supposed to do. They're businesses. But we don't have counterbalancing lobbies that really speak for the interests of patients. And we need them. Is that it? Are we? We're close to done.
We have time for maybe one more question. Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
No, I've got another. Yeah.
Just in reference to the necessity for families to get together and be honest. My father, who's one the single most educated person I've ever personally known, was in a state of dementia, had a physical problem. They thought it was a heart problem. He had been treated for years, and it turned out to be a gallbladder problem, which is not uncommon.
Huh.
And so the doctors told us, you need to get the whole family, anybody in the family that wants to come,
yeah,
come. And the discussion, and they came in from all over the country. Yeah. We had a discussion as to whether or not to insert the pacemaker. And then we called the doctor in, and we came to the conclusion that we would not do so. And he said, okay. This was on a Saturday, and he was in a hurry to get out for the weekend. And he failed to sign the papers. They inserted a pacemaker, and he lived a life of misery and died in the hospital about 4 weeks later. So make sure whenever a decision is made that it's followed. Same thing with my mother. She was going to live to be 100. That was her goal. But the last 7 years, a slow-acting dementia happened. But we were able, my sisters wanted to keep her alive at all costs, and I just absolutely ran the risk of not being their favorite brother, even though I was their only brother, by telling them that that wasn't going to happen. And my sister lives in Maryland, a widow lady, came down to North Carolina to be with my mother, and I went in after about 6 months. Yeah. And you may know the name of the book. It's something like This Day Has 36 Hours.
Oh, yes.
Is that the name? The
it's
title?
A 36-hour day. Yeah.
36-hour day. I would recommend that to anybody. But I went in one afternoon after work, and I looked at my sister, and that 6 months that she was there, she looked to me like she had aged 3, 4, 5 years. And I said to her, and I was paying her, I insisted on that, paying her the exact same thing that an outside caregiver would give, because she needed an income.
Yeah.
I said, you are going back to Maryland, and in less than a week, I said, if I have to continue paying you, you're going to go to Maryland. And she's still alive, by the way, my sister in Maryland. But she would not have been, I am convinced, had I not And I was very unpopular with my sisters for a while, but they love me now. So,
thank you. That's a beautiful, beautiful story to end on. And I, let's see, I've got like 2 minutes, don't I? Yeah. So I want to tell you a very, very brief story. You know, we were all like a smarty pants family, right? Highly educated. And I had to research a whole book to feel actually okay about the kinds of things that my mother, you know, my mother's decision, our decisions regarding my dad. But this is not something only for that only highly educated people can figure out. My sweetheart's name is Brian, and he grew up in Queens in a duplex. And on the other side of the duplex from him were his cousins, and that included his cousin George, who is an auto mechanic on Long Island, has only high school education, and his aunt Dot, who was like the most beloved person in that extended family. And when Aunt Dot was 92, she was at a farm family party. She's eating something I guess you love in the South, which is red velvet cake. And she had a massive fainting spell. And they were afraid she was dying. And they took her to the hospital. And the doctor came out and said to George, who happens to be 6'4", well over 250 pounds, and said to him, "We want to keep her overnight. We want to run numerous tests, and we're thinking about a pacemaker." And George just stood up, leaned, which I'm sure he's done many times before, other people too, but he just stood up and he leaned over the doctor and said, "Ain't freaking gonna happen." She was halfway through eating a piece of red velvet cake, and the only thing she wants is to go home and finish that cake. And that's what we're going to do. And so he took her home. He had several interchanges like this with people in medicine who wanted to do something fairly invasive and big on a very old lady. And he actually had experiences where the doctor would say, "Well, we really think you should do this." And he would say, "Absolutely not." And they'd say, "Are you denying her medical care? Are you going to sign her out against medical advice?" And then when George said, "Absolutely not, it's not going to happen," they would kind of look around and then kind of lean over, make sure no one else was listening, and say, "I think you're making the right choice. If it was my mother, I'd do the same thing." So it's a strange medical system. So anyway, Aunt Dot lived to be 97, and she died in her own bed. And her son was a very devout Catholic, and he said these were incredibly difficult decisions for him because he liked to live in a world of black and white, and all of this was gray. But when she was in the nursing home, he signed orders that said, "Do not transport," which means don't take to the hospital, you know, "do not put a tube in." And it was not easy, but she had a peaceful death in her own bed in the nursing home where she lived at the very end of her life, very much beloved and visited. So it's a very helpful story for me because, to me, that red velvet cake just symbolizes all of the quality of life issues. You know, if you're getting to the point where you're depriving them of whatever their equivalent of red velvet cake is, really give it some serious thought. And thank you so much for being here. Yeah.